Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Giorgio Tsoukalos. He has been the director of Erik von Däniken's Center for Ancient Astronaut Research for over 12 years. And he is also the publisher of Legendary Times magazine, the world's only and definitive ancient astronaut research journal. I will also add that as the world's leading ancient astronaut expert, he has starred in and appeared on the History Channel, the Travel Channel, the National Geographic Channel, the Sci-Fi Channel, Coast to Coast AM, and many other international television and radio programs such as UFO Hunters and Ancient Aliens, reporting about the latest discoveries in the ancient astronaut field. Oh, after that, welcome to the program, Giorgio.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a delight.
Well, I must say I feel very privileged. Over the last few weeks here in the UK, we've been watching your series, Ancient Aliens, and I must say, I'm not saying it because you are my guest, it's one of the best presented ones I've seen, and what I like very much is that you don't feel obliged to keep wheeling on people that are very sceptical.
Right, no, that's definitely one thing that sets apart Ancient Aliens from all the other shows, is that, for the first time ever, we are given a platform in which to voice our opinion and our theories in a way where in the next soundbite we're not being shut down by somebody else. So, there are scientists on the program, there are professors on the program, but at the same time, they're essentially corroborating what we're trying to ask, and all we ask in the program Ancient Aliens is, what if? What if ancient man had in fact been visited by flesh and blood extraterrestrials in the remote past?
Yes, indeed, and I do feel very much that your positive attitude towards the whole question of ancient aliens comes over very strongly. Now, as the director of Erik von Däniken's Center, looking back at his work, what do you think of it in light of what we know today?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting because, as we all know, Erik first published Chariots of the Gods in English in 1970. The book had come out a few years earlier already in the German language. And, in that book, there's a couple of sections in there where Erik, for example, writes that, it is possible that we have come about by a genetic mutation of our genes that has been performed by extraterrestrials on our ancestors in the remote past. And, today, what's really fascinating is the fact that geneticists, who are now a big component of evolutionary biology, there are two camps right now. One camp, they explain everything away with coincidence, and then another camp explains it away with that, something happened there and it had to have been God, as in the God of the Bible. And so those people are called intelligent design people. And, unfortunately, neither side is correct. What has to happen is that both sides have to meet in the middle that, yes, definitely there is an evolutionary record, and yes, definitely something happened in our past, but it had nothing to do with, the God from the Bible or God, because whatever the God was in the Bible, according to the ancient astronaut theory, that was nothing else than a misunderstood, a misinterpreted flesh and blood extraterrestrial.
Right. Do you think in that event that a lot of the writings in the Old Testament, for example, seem to link in with the Sumerian stories, where I think we could accept that they did have contact with aliens? In fact, it seems they allowed the aliens to present themselves as gods, and they were ruled by them for quite some time. I'm sure you're aware of the history there. So what do you think about that link there?
Well, of course. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, the ancient astronaut theory tries to prove whether or not extraterrestrials have visited Earth in the remote past. And one of the earliest accounts of such events we can find in the ancient texts of Sumeria. And there we have stories that talk about the Anunnaki. And the Anunnaki were these beings that appeared from the sky and taught mankind all sorts of various academic disciplines. I mean, they taught them in mathematics, in engineering, agriculture, also in astronomy, all those different fields of science. And what's really interesting is the fact that the word Anunnaki, translated into English, means those who from the heavens came. And that, to me, is something very interesting because, unfortunately, what mainstream archaeology or mainstream science does today is they look at all these ancient stories of the gods, and we find these stories of the gods in every ancient culture all around the world on every continent, that these stories, according to our mainstream archaeologists, are nothing else but a figment of our ancestors' imagination, something to explain away nature, something with which to explain away, you know, thunder and rain and lightning and all those different things. And, that to me doesn't hold up, because since when does nature give you instruction on how to build a structure or how to, perform mathematics or to measure something and things like that? So, and in most cases, these ancient stories are actually eyewitness accounts where the guy or the witness says, and then I saw this, and then I saw that, and then I met that guy. And so it's very clear that something happened in our past where we've been visited, and according to people like me and Eric von Daniken, we've been visited by flesh and blood extraterrestrials thousands of years ago.
Right. Now, what I found interesting was that some of the names in the Sumerian, on the Sumerian tablets, such as the gods Enlil and Enki, are actually mentioned in the Old Testament, which rather gives proof of them having actually lived.
Right, and that there is definitely a connection, because, see, another thing that nobody knows, of course there's people that know this, otherwise I wouldn't be talking about it, but what many people are not aware about is that, the Old Testament especially is quite a big work of, it's a plagiarized work, because people think that it's the first time in the world's history that we have an account of a flood. And that is incorrect, because we already have accounts of previous floods in other, quote-unquote, sacred texts. And one of them, since we're talking about the Sumerians, is in fact mentioned in the Gilgamesh epic, in which Gilgamesh, the hero of the Sumerians, had to go on this journey, on this mission. And also there we have, an account of a flood. And we have accounts of a flood in many, many different other cultures. And so it's very interesting to see that there are certain things that have happened in our past that seem to have happened in multiple cultures all at the same – well, not necessarily all at the same time. But it's as if this collective consciousness was aware that something along the line, something significant happened, and one of these significant events was that the gods, quote-unquote, lowercase g, descended from the sky and taught mankind in various disciplines.
Yes, I certainly believe that. Now, you're very well-traveled. Have you actually been to Sumeria?
No, and, Sumeria is present-day Iraq and present-day Iran. And that's, I'm crazy, but I'm not that crazy.
Right. The only reason I asked you that is I understand that the Sumerians actually built a temple, which I think they called the Temple of Jupiter, for the spacecraft to land on. Were you aware of that?
Yes, absolutely. And what you're referring to is in present-day Lebanon, and it's a site that today is called Baalbek, and everyone can go and Google this. It's B. It's spelled B-A-A-L-B-E-K, Baalbek, and that is the modern-day name for an ancient site called Heliopolis. And by and large, today it is accepted that it was a Roman temple. And guess what? Yes, it was absolutely a Roman temple for the years that the Romans were ruling in that area. And still today, you can see the columns there. It is absolutely beautiful and marvelous. And in fact, still today, it is considered the largest Roman temple that was ever built. Which is really interesting, because to think that, you know, the largest Roman temple wasn't somewhere in Italy, but it's actually in Lebanon. So that's very fascinating to me. However, here's the crazy part. Sure, the Romans 100% did build something. They erected a structure at that site. However, they themselves said that we're building something here because we are worshiping the previous gods that existed on Earth. And so that Roman temple was built way, way older foundation walls. In fact, the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, who of course preceded the Romans, they already knew about that temple as well. And then also, we know this, the Egyptians knew about that area. And so the foundation walls that we find there go back as far as the Egyptian high culture. And now, anyone that goes and Googles Heliopolis or Baalbek will see these magnificent, huge stone blocks that have been used in order to build Baalbek or Heliopolis. And some of these stones have been estimated to weigh in excess of 1,500 metric tons. That's 1,500 metric tons. And that is something we could not replicate today. Not just replicating it by, moving it around from point A to point B. I mean, that would be the biggest problem that we have, because our cranes and machines today, they kind of peter out at around 1,200 metric tons.
Right, yes. So do you believe one of the stories which I tend to feel answers that problem is that in the olden days the ancients had mastered sound? Perhaps the technology was given to them by aliens, and they could levitate these blocks into place.
I mean, that is the solution that seems to be most likely, because it is absolutely ridiculous to suggest that these ancient blocks were moved by string and were carved with chicken bones, because that is exactly what, modern-day archaeology suggests, that all of these ancient... I am aware that our ancestors, 100%, they knew how to cut stone. There's absolutely no question in my mind that they knew how to cut stone. They were able to cut limestone, sandstone. They were, they were able to cut all the types of, I call them the soft stones. But that's not what I'm interested in. What I'm interested in is stones like at Baalbek, for example, where we're talking about granite. We're talking about diorite, andesite, really hard igneous rock, where today we cut granite with diamond-tipped saws. So to suggest that our ancestors, according to the mainstream archaeologists, that they did this with a saw that's attached to a bow, and then they used some chicken bones to carve it. I mean, or they used copper on hard igneous rock. I mean, that is a pathetic. I'm sorry, a pathetic answer. And no, I'm not really sorry. No.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you on that.
No, to quickly answer your question, I'm sorry to go on about this. So is it possible that they have unlocked the secret of sound levitation? And the answer is yes, because, I mean, there are stories, for example, in ancient Egypt, where it is said that some of these blocks were moved by pouring a white substance on top of an obelisk or on top of a big block of stone, and then some quote-unquote incantations had to take place, and then all of a sudden, as if by magic, the stone would levitate, and then you could push the stone, and the stone would move. Now, of course, the text says that these were magic incantations, that it had to do something with magic or, divine power. Now, I have to be very clear about this to our listeners, and that is magic in such a sense does not exist. There was no such thing as a divine power that helped with this. What it was some type of a technology that our ancestors didn't understand the nuts and bolts behind it, so they thought it was magic. Because we all know today, magic, you know, except for falling in love or hanging out with friends, I mean, yes, that's all magic. That can be considered magic. Yeah. But, you know, magic in the Harry Potter sense really does not exist, and it never has. If anything, that type of magic was misunderstood technology.
Yes, yeah. Excellent answer, I must say. Again, if I can refer to your travels, did you ever get to see the so-called Venus Gate?
No, I have not. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. I'm only in photographs, like most people. I wondered what your opinion was of it, because it's supposed to, as far as I understand, record a visit by Venusians.
Right, and you know, I really don't have much of an opinion about it, because the moment that, it gives specifics about, let's say with that gate, it says that, you know, it was apparently was built because of visits from Venusians, that to me is a bit too specific. See, and this is why, you know, there are so many people today in the UFO field or in the alternative history field where they say, you know, the extraterrestrials, they arrived from the Pleiadians, the extraterrestrials arrived from Nibiru, or the extraterrestrials arrived from God knows where. And, you know, and that to me is kind of a disservice to the whole UFO field, because the fact alone that we have been visited by extraterrestrials and probably still are being visited today, that is sensational enough for a general public, you know, for them to have to swallow this. Because if you say, you know, by the way, we've been visited by extraterrestrials in the past, that's enough for the general public to wrap their heads around this. The moment that, you know, you have to fill in the story with, yes, and then they came from this planet, and then their spaceship's name was this, and then their commander's name was so-and-so, that's too much. Because the fact alone that we've been visited by extraterrestrials, that's sensational enough for the general public. But yeah, look, I mean, the ancient monuments definitely, many of them hold great, great mysteries still to this day, even though mainstream archaeology would want to have us believe otherwise.
Right, yes. Now, still on the subject of Venusians, what did you think of the George Adamski contact in the desert?
Well, you know, anything having to do with modern-day ufology, like George Adamski and you know, current day or modern day contact stories and abductions and things like that. I'll be honest with you, I am not as well versed, if at all, in these topics because that is not my area of expertise. I'm an ancient astronaut guy. So my UFOs or my contact stories happened thousands of years ago. Now, having said that, you know, look, if out of the 15,000 UFO reports or whatever it is that come in or are reported every year, even if 14,999 UFO reports are indeed fake or are not real UFOs, well, that still leaves us with one real UFO report, and that's all that's needed. And of the thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people who have claimed to have been abducted, are they really all liars? Of course not. So to suggest that, you know, abduction stories or UFO reports, that all of them are wrong, that it makes no sense because, yes, obviously a lot of people want to draw attention to themselves, but a lot of people that I know personally, they have told me they pray every day or they ask the universe every day, why has this happened to me? Because they don't want it to happen. So, you know, it's a very, very thin line that with this whole, you know, modern-day UFO phenomenon where it's a big question.
Right. Now, speaking personally, I have had more than one UFO sighting, and I had one particular one, which I would say, without any doubt, was a genuine one at night time. Now, what about yourself? This strong interest you have in UFOs and aliens, have you had some earlier experience which has sort of grabbed your attention and got you into the subject?
The quick answer is no. I have never seen a UFO. I have never been visited by any extraterrestrials. I have never channeled any type of information or anything like this. But to me, you see, the evidence that I have come across is beyond, it's beyond crystal clear. So, you know, I am not in need to see a UFO because, you know, the work that I do, I don't believe in UFOs. I don't believe in extraterrestrials. I know, I am convinced that they exist. See, because many times I try to tell people that if you say that you believe in aliens or you believe in extraterrestrials, I mean, sorry, in UFOs, then the word belief, if you look at it from a semantic standpoint, it suggests a type of faith. I don't have faith in extraterrestrials. I know they exist, I'm convinced, and I know they were here in the past. I mean, that is as easy as it gets. And so, you know, but I have to say also that we're all a product of our upbringing. And so even though I grew up in a Catholic household, these topics, especially, you know, the paranormal with ghosts or you know, Atlantis and things like that, you know, those topics were very frequently discussed, especially when my grandmother and my grandfather would visit. I mean, you know, those were normal topics of discussion. And I'm very thankful for it because I was exposed at a very early age to these ideas. And, you know, like I said, I think we're all a product of our upbringing.
Yes, I'm sure that our parents and other relations do influence us to a great extent. Well, I think it's remarkable in a way that you have such a positive approach based on something, I suppose, inside you that is very much attracted to this subject. Now, what do you think is the strongest evidence for the existence of aliens?
Well, I mean, this is, of course, a big question.
Absolutely.
Because,
<yes.
laughs> you see, it's not one single piece. Because what makes the ancient astronaut theory so compelling, in my opinion, is that, you know, we have so many indications in virtually every field of science, but also out in the field, out in nature and with ancient structures and things like this. So, you know, to pick one, like many people would say, oh, you know, it's the Great Pyramids at Egypt. Well,
right.
Not in my opinion. I mean, yes, the Great Pyramids, the whole Giza Plateau is 100% a huge component of the larger picture. But like I said, you know, it's the combination of all the... See, I liken it to a big puzzle. And what I do is I collect puzzle pieces, and, you know, we put the puzzle pieces together, and over time, and it's, of course, a very large puzzle, it takes a very long time to complete, but anyone who has ever completed or worked on a puzzle knows that the more pieces you put into place, even though the puzzle itself is not yet completed, you know exactly what the puzzle looks like because you can see it. You can see the finished product. And that is the same with the ancient astronaut theory. And so, you know, there are many, you know, there's textual references that we have carvings, we have little figurines and statues,
yes.
And then we have the magnificent structures that still today our engineers would have a hard time replicating. And by the way, just as a quick interjection, I am not one of those people who say that the pyramids, for example, were built by aliens. Of course not. They were built by human beings because that's exactly what it says in the ancient text, that the Egyptians built the pyramids. But, and here is the big, big but and the big difference, is that it also says, yes, the Egyptian built the pyramids, with the assistance of the guardians of the sky. And the guardians of the sky, according to ancient astronaut theorists, were flesh and blood extraterrestrials. So they did exactly what you suggested earlier, that we were given technology with which to build certain structures, highly sophisticated, advanced technology that obviously over time has been lost or, quite frankly, those extraterrestrials, when they left, they took that stuff with them.
Hmm. And I recall in one of your ancient alien programs talking about the pyramids that, of course, one can hardly refer to them without noting that the layout represents the Orion star system. So one would think from that, unless the Egyptians particularly wanted to do it of their own accord, maybe it is in recognition of the Orions coming to them. Do you think that's a reasonable explanation?
Yes, absolutely. And that is really a fascinating story that a fellow Englishman, Robert Bovall, actually wrote about this in the Orion Mystery in the 90s, where he came up by looking at a bird's eye perspective of...
Right, Giorgio, you were about to tell me something connected with Robert Bovall and the Great Pyramids, so perhaps you could pick it up from there.
Where was I?
Okay. Well, it's the Orion connection, isn't it?
Right, the Orion connection. So, Robert Bovall in the 1990s wrote a book called The Orion Connection, and essentially what he did was he looked at a picture of the Great Pyramid Complex at Giza from a bird's eye perspective, and he thought that it was very odd that the smallest pyramid out of the three was a bit off. It wasn't in complete alignment of the other two pyramids.
Right.
So he said, you know, this looks very interesting, and quite frankly, it reminds me of Orion's belt. And sure enough, he did, exceptionally detailed research, and he came to the conclusion that, in fact, the three pyramids that we have on the Giza Plateau, the three big ones, that they have been built exactly in ratio and in the alignment of Orion's belt. And what's really fascinating is the fact that if you were to put a, you know, three big floodlights on top of the pyramids and shoot them straight up into the sky, similar to the Luxor pyramid at the Luxor Hotel in Las Vegas. It has a gigantic light fixture at the very top, and it shoots up a massive light beam of light into the sky, and at night you can see that beam of light in Las Vegas for miles and miles away. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. So imagine doing that with the three pyramids in Egypt. And if you point those beams of light straight into the air, he used computer programs, astronomical computer programs, to determine, well, at what time did those three pyramids actually line up with Orion's belt? And much to his great surprise, the three pyramids lined up with Orion's belt about 12,500 years ago, which, according to the ancient Egyptians, that was their golden age. And that golden age was way before the first pharaohs ever came along, way before any of the modern-day, well, not modern-day, but the quote-unquote normal Egyptological happenings happened according to the mainstream Egyptologists. Yet, his research is being ridiculed. Everyone says, ah, that can't be true. The pyramids were built, you know, in 3,000 B.C., well, 2,500 B.C., so 4,500 years ago. There is no way that they could have been built in 10,000 B.C. and things like that, even though the ancient texts, especially some Egyptian texts, are saying this. And not only that, but Greek historians afterwards, like Herodotus, for example, they also, because they were great travelers and chroniclers, and they were in Egypt at the libraries of Alexandria and places like that, where they did have access to all these records before they were burnt down. And in those records, they read that other kings and other gods reigned in Egypt way before their current time. And here we are today and saying that all of these things could have never happened, and that all those stories are nothing else. All these stories that have been written down on paper or papyrus or whatever, that all these ancient stories are wrong and a figment of our ancestors' imagination. I mean, it's the same thing if somebody, you know, finds a newspaper or a magazine or a book that talks about the moon landing. They find a book like that 5,000 years from now in the future, and then they'll say, oh, yeah, that book is fiction. That never happened. I mean, that is right. Exactly what we are doing today with our ancestors, and that is what gets me fired up, because that is an insult to our ancestors' intelligence.
Absolutely, I quite believe you there. Now, you mentioned in one of the ancient alien programs again something to do with DNA, and I think some scientists today allege that they can identify alien DNA. Now, there seemed to be a conclusion that some skeletons or whatever that they've examined, or skulls, are not totally human. But what do you know about that area?
Well, I'm really happy that you would bring up such a wonderful question, because, see, to me, I think the ultimate proof of that we've been visited by extraterrestrials, or are still being visited by extraterrestrials still today, it won't come in finding a crashed spaceship. It won't be in the form of, you know, finding a ray gun or something like this, but it'll come in the form of our own DNA, because one of the basic tenets of the ancient astronaut theory is that a long time ago, a genetic mutation of our genes took place that essentially, quote-unquote, made us human. Because one thing, like I was saying at the outset of this program, is very clear, that yes, there is an evolutionary record. There is no question that, you know, a type of evolution did take place. But even Charles Darwin, anyone who has read even portions of The Origins of Species, knows that Charles Darwin, while he was totally enamored with his idea, with his theory, even he himself concluded that something doesn't make sense. There are inadequacies in his theory. So that is why today we have what is known as the missing link. Because what we have is we have all, because ordinary evolution essentially suggests that you have a transitory evolution from one species to the next with an intermediary species, and then, you know, there's a slight change in the body, and then, you have the next species. So everything is very clear, and, you know, it's a smooth transition. That is what ordinary evolution suggests. However, the fossil record is just the opposite, and that is that, yes, we have multiple human ancestors. There is no question about that. However, in between these multiple human ancestors, there are gaps of millions of years and hundreds of thousands of years where something should have happened. There should have been this intermediary species that, you know, was right. the transition between species A and species B. Well, it does not exist. So what we are suggesting is that the missing link was that, you know, direct intervention of our human genes in the remote past. And if we look at the ancient texts, and most prominently for our listeners, of course, the Bible, it says in there, and then God created man in their own image. So now, what does that even mean? I mean, grammatically speaking, it's an incorrect sentence, because you have God and then you have there later on in the sentence. And the theologians say, oh, you know, and by there they just mean the Holy Trinity. But any Hebrew scholar can tell you that the word for God in Hebrew is Elohim, and that can only be translated, as you know, as a plural. It means the gods.
Right,
so then, if you substitute the word God with gods, and then it says, and then the gods created man in their own image, everything all of a sudden becomes way more clear. And so, you know, I'm always asked, so Giorgio, what do you think these extraterrestrials look like? And to be honest with you, that's the wrong question to ask, because according to the ancient texts, we've been created in their image. So the question is, do we look like the extraterrestrials? And the answer is yes.
Right.
Because we're half human and half extraterrestrial breeds already. Because if they've manipulated our genes, then I think, just like what you said at the beginning of this question, that particular mutation will be found. It probably already has been found, and we're not being told. Who knows? Because one thing I know is that in order to clone a human being, you only need 4% of the DNA makeup. All other 96% are considered today by scientists to be genetic junk. And that, to me, is also another weird suggestion, because just because we don't know how to decipher those 96% doesn't mean it's worthless.
Absolutely, yes, I agree with you there. I did read a story, or I must have seen a documentary on television. I'm not sure if it was in one of yours, where someone was making the point that if you look at the fetus of a human baby, it has a tail. And then when they compared that to a reptile, they found the same formation. And the inference from that was that somewhere in our past we have been sort of the hybrid also of a reptilian. Are you aware of that story?
Yes, I've heard that and I've seen the pictures, and it's very interesting, and it says something. I mean, it really. I don't subscribe to the whole reptilian theory of reptilians being evil or that they even exist. I mean, I am not much of a quote unquote alien conspiracy theorist. I am more of a subscriber of the visit in the past was a benevolent thing. Yes, there's some horrible things have happened, but by and large, we were visited by quote unquote benevolent extraterrestrials. And so the whole idea that today the government is run by, or the world governments are run by reptilians, and I mean, that to me is a very hard pill to swallow, and it's a pill that I frankly have never swallowed, and I never will. But that doesn't change the fact that, if you look at an embryo, that at first, when the embryo first develops, or the fetus, that is virtually indistinguishable from all other, mammals that we have. I mean, that to me is highly fascinating. Mm-hmm. But not everything. Not everything has to do with extraterrestrials either.
No, it's just an interesting point as we were talking about DNA. We've got about a good 10 minutes or so left, so I didn't want to get you into another big subject, but I would be interested to know if, again, on your travels, you ever found contact with the crystal skulls.
I have seen crystal skulls at museums. I have been in close proximity with a recent crystal skull. Compassion that has been, has recently, quote unquote, been released. But by and large, I have not paid any, big attention to crystal skulls. I mean, they're a fascinating topic, but they to me don't scream extraterrestrials. Like I said, it's a fascinating topic. It's interesting that we today use crystal technology in order to store information inside computers. Of course, they're artificially created crystals. So in that respect, it's highly interesting. And also what I find interesting is that when in the late 19 or mid-1960s, when the Mitchell Hedges skull was examined by the laboratories at Hewlett-Packard, the scientists there came to one conclusion, and I quote, "This skull should not exist." And, stuff like that is fascinating. Do I know anything more about it? Not really. I mean, look, it's allegedly there's 13 skulls that apparently exist on planet Earth. Six of them, providing that they are the right ones, have been found. The other ones are still somewhere hidden away. And according to Native American myths, each of these skulls contains the information of one of their home planets. Because according to the Native American myths, our galaxy contains 13 inhabitable planets. 12 inhabitable worlds, and we are the youngest of those inhabitable worlds, and that's why planet Earth, still today, in Native American myths, we're referred to as the planet of the children, and that is absolutely correct, because we're imbeciles. And so these 13 skulls, because according to Native American myth, planet Earth has been seeded by the star people a long time ago, and they brought, these crystal skulls with them like I said, each one of them contains the knowledge of each of these other 11 planets that are out there, and apparently the 13th skull, which is the biggest, is kind of the backup skull that contains all the information of all 12 planets combined. Now, that's an interesting story, and mind you, it's a story, but as with every story, with every myth, with every legend, there is some truth behind it. It's a core of truth, and especially when this story talks about star people, that is when my ears perk up.
Right. Now, do I recall correctly that the Mitchell Hedges skull is one that literally sort of speaks?
Well, that depends on your constitution. If you have a propensity for tuning in to that realm, yes. You know, and also there's another skull called Max that apparently has, you know, speaks to people. And of course, they you know, it's not like they move the jaw and then they talk. I mean, it's all mental. It's all telepathic, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
But like I said, I've been with a couple of these skulls, and absolutely nothing has happened to me. So, you know, I'm not too much into the hocus pocus, into the hocus pocus aspect of this whole field. I'm a nuts and bolts technology guy, and while I don't discount, you know, people saying that these skulls have talked to them, because who the heck am I to say that, you know, that they're not speaking the truth? And therein lies the big difference, that too many people are considered kooks just because they actually have the courage to come forward and explain exactly what they've experienced.
Yes. Now, one of the stories in your series, again, that I found particularly intriguing was the Dropa skeletons with their abnormally large skulls. Would you have put that down to some sort of extraterrestrial sort of interference?
Well, it is possible. I mean, it's really fascinating that the Dropa are this bizarre... See, it hasn't yet been corroborated 100% because no pictures have ever been released of the Dropa that, you know, we know that actually might have existed. But apparently, in the Bayankara-Ula mountain range of China, a UFO or a spaceship at one time crashed, and there were survivors. And so still today, apparently in that region, which is apparently inaccessible because it's a military installation or it's a military area, this tribe still exists. And they're these short, spindly beings with large heads, kind of like grays or something like this. And what's really interesting is also that in that area, they also found the Dropa discs. And the Dropa discs are these, they look like a discus. And, you know, they have these weird grooves on them. And apparently in the 60s or so, somebody put these things on a record player, and it played a very bizarre sound. Now, like I said, I have a bit of a difficulty, you know, believing a story where a stone record or a stone disc was put on an actual record player, and then that apparently should have played a sound. I just don't see it. But the discs are there. Well, not anymore today. They've disappeared. The local stories of the Dropa exist. So, you know, there is something there. Do I know exactly what it is? Of course not. But I'm not going to just, you know, throw the story out the window and say there is nothing there. Because the moment we do something like that, we've kind of, that's very unscientific to just, you know, throw things out the window where we think we know all the answers, because, as you know, we don't.
Right. Now, unfortunately, Georgist, we come to virtually the end of the programme here. I have to take a minute or two to advertise next week's, but before we close, would you like to give your website and any information regarding what is available there and your Legendary Times book aspect?
Sure. No, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. And before I conclude here, I would like to say that we are currently filming Season 3 of Ancient Aliens.
Wonderful.
And in the United States, the first episode will air this summer, 2011, in the beginning or mid-July. So hopefully those programs will hit England as fast as possible after their release.
So.
But as far as what I do is concerned and how you can be a part of my universe, definitely check out legendarytimes.com. But I also am on Facebook at facebook.com/ Giorgio Tsoukalos fans. And on Twitter, you can follow me, Twitter @ Tsoukalos, Tsoukalos. And there I give almost weekly updates of what's going on, lectures I give, and if you are dying to read a new book, just go to legendarytimesbooks.com, and we have one of the most comprehensive ancient astronaut bookstores in the world.
That's wonderful. Now, if people go to your site, will they get links or information that would take them to Facebook and the other one?
Yes, of course. Absolutely.
That's fine. Okay. Right. A couple of minutes left. Is there anything you would like to say about the immediate future? Because there is some talk about the likelihood of having some sort of open contact with extraterrestrials.
That would be nice. That would be nice. And, you know, of course, here in the United States, everyone is going crazy about 2012 next year. And emphasis on going crazy because it's all for nothing, because absolutely nothing will happen next year. Do I think that something major will happen regarding extraterrestrials as in a public or official contact in the next year or two? I don't think so. However, will we make such an anticipated contact within our lifetime, meaning in the next 30 to 40 years? I think so, yes. I mean, but see, before that happens, we need to clean up our own house because right now we are still a very dangerous planet. We've got all the tools within our hearts to respect each other and be nice to each other. And until we have figured out how that happens, I don't think we'll make official contact.
Right, so that concludes the interview with you, and it's been wonderful to hear you speaking, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm sure our listeners have. So thank you very, very much for coming onto the program.
Thank you very much for having me, and time flew by here like nothing, so let's do this again.
Absolutely, I'd love to. Thanks a lot. Right, friends, another very extremely interesting guest. Next week I have Carlo Ammi, who's just completed a book that was given to him by his guides, and he believes that it's a powerful tool for many in the process of ascension. It's a new genre of spiritual self-help book that guides the reader, he says, to find their deepest answers within themselves. So that'll be my guest next week. Thank you for being with me today. Hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you very much.